Well, if you plan on driving any distances in your car, you might be interested in what Jane and Michael Stern have to say. They have rewritten their guidebook, Road Food, which is a guide to inexpensive regional restaurants around the country, all within 10 miles of a highway. You know what it's like when you're on a road and you're hungry and you don't want a boiled hamburger or some other horrible food atrocity. You want something good and tasty and cheap. Well, they've tried to figure out ways of finding these restaurants and have made a guide to them. They've collaborated on some other books as well, books like Auto Ads and Amazing America, and a book called Trucker, A Portrait of the Last American Cowboy. When I spoke with Jane and Michael Stern, I asked them how they developed a passion for road food.
Well, I think because my mother was such a terrible cook that she always took us out to restaurants, and I got used to eating in them. And really, the road food part of that came about when we finished the Trucker book. And Michael and I did this book partially together, and the part we did together where we were in the car, we had heard the myth, "Don't, you know, if you want a good meal, follow the truckers," and I guess came to find out that wasn't true.
In fact, while we were doing the Trucker book, it got to be just one of the things we hated most about doing the book. I mean, the one thing that we really did hate was eating, simply because we were eating in truck stops meal after meal, and it got to the point where we just couldn't stand it anymore. And we really just said, "This is it. We're putting our feet down. We're going to interview the truckers. We're going to go with them. We're going to talk with them in the truck stops. But when it comes time to eating, we're going to get off the highway and see if we can find a decent meal." And so, long before we ever had the idea to do the book Road Food, we found ourselves looking for it, even before we even knew that name.
You're undermining a great American myth, and that's
Oh, I
the myth of
know.
the truck stop. What's wrong with truck stops?
Well, I think they used to be really good, but now the reason truckers eat in them is because there's no place else they can park that 18-wheel rig. You know, a lot of little great cafes don't have the parking facilities, so the truckers are sort of prisoners of the highway, and they go in there looking for a good meal, and what they get is a microwave oven type thing for exorbitant prices. And the really good food is maybe on the what are now secondary highways where the truckers used to go, the little ma-and-pa cafes that the truckers can't get to anymore, but we can.
Do you think that that's changed? You know, that the bad food at truck stops and the expensive prices is something recent?
Definitely, I think it's definitely a product of the fact that they're all franchised and the fact that basically the truck stops have a captive audience. Truckers and tourists, you know, driving along the highway basically don't want to wander around off the highway for 15, 20 minutes or a half hour, maybe finding good food, but maybe not. So they say, you know, "What the hell? Let's go to the truck stop and eat there. At least we won't get killed, you know, or poisoned or something."
That's interesting because the last time I stopped at a truck stop, I thought I was going to get killed. It was in Connecticut in a small little town, and it said truck stop. So I nudged my friend and I said, "Hey, these truck stops, they're the great places to stop in. Why don't we go in here and get something to eat?" And it should have been called Bike Stop because everyone in it was actually not a truck driver, but rather a biker.
Uh-oh.
And there were a lot of very tough-looking people who thought that we were invaders from Mars. And we got out of there real quick. Very, very hostile vibrations being directed towards us there.
Well, you know, that's funny. There's a trucker myth. I guess it's sort of an apocryphal story about, and it was actually made into a song not too long ago about the trucker who goes into the diner and there's a bunch of bikers there. Remember? And the bikers hassle him and the trucker just sits there and takes it, but when he leaves the diner, he backs up over in all their Harley Davidsons and crushes them. And when I first heard the story, I thought, "Oh, well, this must be true." Then I heard it from about 67 truckers and realized it was
All of
definitely a
whom knew the
myth.
guy that did it.
Right.
Oh, that's great. I never heard the song. When you're on the road, since you don't want to eat at the truck stops, how do you take your chances? Because I just really have no system at all for figuring out which exit to get off at. And then if it says food and there's arrows pointing in each directions, I just stop there and I can't figure out if I should turn right or
Exactly.
turn
Well, it's
left.
really, if you're traveling and looking for a good meal, it's really potluck. And we spent an awful lot of time making mistakes while we were writing Road Food. You know, there are 450 restaurants in the book. There are probably 4,000 that aren't in the book that we looked at, walked in, maybe even ordered a meal, or maybe even ate half a meal, and then decided, no way. But what we do, what we did anyway, while we were researching road food, was to really just stay off the highways and take the routes that ran parallel to the highways or nearby them, and tried to go through the small towns. I mean, the old truck stops, many of those have gone out of business, and we found really the best bet for locating good food was to go to a small town and look for a cafe, a tea room.
You do develop radar after a while. I mean, we would, if let's say a place had an old rodeo poster in the window, or the sheriff's car was there, or they had a big round table in the front window with all the local guys in overalls sitting there, you kind of said, well, if the locals eat here, it's got to be good. On the other hand, if the thing has a giant billboard on the highway and says home cooking, you know, or
bus
something,
is
you
can,
bus is welcome, right? You know to avoid it. You also never ask the clerk at the hotel where to eat, because he sends you to the spinning thing on top of the tallest building in town.
One of the other things we found is that when we first started really thinking about doing road food, we would pull into small towns and say, where's there a good restaurant? And we would always get sent to the most expensive, you know, L'Escargot or something in a small town. And that's usually really awful.
It's the spinner.
The one that spins. So what we started to do when we did ask people was to ask them, where do you eat if you don't want a fancy meal? And then we started finding ourselves clued into road food. I remember sometimes in the morning when we were looking for breakfast, I mean, this sounds silly, but we would just roll the windows down and drive through a town, you know, and try and smell where the biscuits were coming from, and occasionally found some good ones.
Oh, gosh. Well, you've told us some clues as to evidences of it being a good restaurant. What are some of the things that you see when you drive by and you know this is not the place for you?
A lot of motorcycles parked outside.
Right, or a lot of Winnebagos or a lot of Greyhound buses, anything that looks like it's for tourists only.
One other thing we did find that's generally true about road food, except in Louisiana, is that places that serve liquor or that specialize in serving liquor are generally not going to have good regional food. For expensive restaurants, of course, that's not true, but for inexpensive road food restaurants, we found that I think we maybe have two or three taverns in the whole book. And other than that, we look for places that looked like family places, that looked friendly, that weren't cinder block bunkers.
But
with
nothing
beer
that
signs.
Bills itself as a family restaurant.
No, that's
because
dangerous.
That usually means it's terrible also. It means it's fast food often.
This is the second edition of your book, Road Food, and the first one came out how many years ago?
78?
2 years ago,
Two years ago, yeah.
Have you kept in touch with any of the people whose restaurants you mentioned in the first book? And have they changed at all? Have a lot of people come, and has that changed the nature of the restaurant?
Well, the ones that changed too much, at least changed and were no longer road food, got dumped for this edition. That was their penalty for getting too famous. The ones that we kept in there are the ones that just sort of took their newfound fame with a noblesse oblige, sort of that they were just going to keep doing the same old down-home cooking no matter what happened to them. And fortunately, that was the case. In most cases, that was
true. Well, you know, when we began doing road food, We sat down and talked with each other, and we said, well, now, should we announce ourselves when we go into the restaurant? Should we say we're doing a guidebook to great regional food? And we debated about it one way or the other, and we finally decided we wouldn't, at least until after we sampled the meal. And I would say of the 450 places in the book, maybe 10 or 15 had any sense of what we were doing when we told them what we were doing, since most of them are so kind of regionally, locally oriented.
Really, you could have been Craig Claiborne and come
and
in
they
and
wouldn't
they really
care
wouldn't
at all.
Have cared. I remember when we started off, we had a long talk about should we or shouldn't we take bribes. This is so ridiculous.
Meals,
or free meals or anything. And I mean, the only thing we were ever offered was a pack of Trident gum from some diner in New Jersey. It just said, here, would you like, you know, have a pack of gum. So we took it. But with the type of food that we write about, it's not like they're going to, like, pay, you know, slip you $100 under the table to get in the book.
The other thing is, unlike, say, a food critic who writes about a small, undiscovered city restaurant, and then the restaurant just becomes jammed with people who want to go there, you know, since the road food restaurants are spread out all across the country, in no cases did, at least none that I know about, were any of these places spoiled by whatever fame they got from the book. There are a few people who did tell us that their business has increased, but I mean, we were pretty happy about that. But no place had to you know, add on a huge dining room to handle the road food clientele.
Didn't Mrs. Ford's coffee shop in Laurinburg, North Carolina, which when we were there you could get a 5-course meal for 75 cents, is now charging 85 cents. So that's about as.
But she blamed that on inflation,
right? Not on fame.
Okay. What are some of the great regional dishes that you tasted on some of your tours on the road?
Oh boy, burgoo is really a wonderful dish. That is from Kentucky.
What is that?
Burgoo is really, it's like a stew that has,
well, traditionally,
it's like a gumbo almost.
It's a kind of gumbo made in northwestern Kentucky, a very small part of the state, in southern Illinois as well. And traditionally, it's a game stew with squirrel, possum, all kinds of things like that. The way they make it now at the Shady Rest restaurant, I believe it's made with ham, beef,
mutton. Then there's funeral pie from Pennsylvania, which is a Pennsylvania Dutch dish, which is a raisin pie. And it used to be stored in pie safes and in cellars when before refrigeration. It's a pie. It's like a mince pie. Are you familiar with it? Have you ever tried
funeral
it?
Pie? No,
yeah.
I haven't.
And it was really the fancy pie that was kept down in a cool cellar until somebody died and then brought out for the funeral because it was, you know, it would keep and it was the fancy thing to eat.
And as long as we're speaking about necrological food, we may as well talk about graveyard stew, which is something you find in the Dakotas, which actually isn't as bad as it sounds. That's the local name for milk toast, so named because it is eaten by people with one foot in the grave.
And then there's Fanny Daddies,
which is one of
the New England nicknames for fried clams. And there's Fosnox, which is a Pennsylvania Dutch. What is it?
It's a
raised donut, isn't it? And I'm trying to think.
Well, of course, in Louisiana, I mean, that's one of the great road food states. We had wonderful Cajun dishes like turtle piquant and, of course, gumbo and catfish.
Peaky bread? Do you know peaky bread?
No.
Peaky bread is one of the weirdest looking things. We first saw it at the Hopi Indian Reservation, which has a restaurant right on the premises, which is really one of the few places you can eat Hopi food. And the bread is made from blue corn, blue maize, and it's ground up and it's fried on a hot stone that has been coated with fat from sheep's brains. This sounds so disgusting, but it doesn't taste as horrible as my description. And it looks like blue strudel. It is the lightest thing, and it's made in the most primitive conditions. And you can get that and Hopi hominy stew as a meal for, I think, $2 or something. And it's really interesting food.
If you go to a place in the Pennsylvania Dutch area and order funeral pie, do you have to have a funeral to go to? Or can
I
you
hope
just
not.
No, no. Actually, the place that we found it was a place called Dorothea's Fort Lowther Restaurant in Carlisle. And she serves
it, Fosnox,
I think, almost
too.
Every day, yeah.
Do you play jukeboxes when you're on the road?
Oh, yeah, sure.
To go with the food, you know.
Right.
It's part of the ambiance.
Music to eat with, yeah.
Were there any outstanding jukeboxes that you came across?
Well, I think my favorite jukebox was at a place called Pete's Pit in Michigan City, Indiana, which is a rib joint. And, it's a 4-star rib joint for starters. It's a little dump by the side of the road with fabulous ribs and sweet potato pie and buffalo fish and a really funky soul food. And they have a pristine Motown jukebox, like from, let's say, 1968, where nothing has changed since 1968. And you've got your Martha and the Vandellas, you know, just blasting out Nowhere to Run. And you're, you know, sort of in the shadow of Detroit eating ribs and listening to Motown. And it's just a primal Motown experience, I think.
A little bit more restrained would be the jukebox at Shirley's Diner in Fickle, Indiana, where we were just kind of looking through the jukebox, and we were amazed to see that they had, among the tunes that they had on the jukebox were Happy Birthday, the Anniversary Waltz, I can't remember, like all kinds of wedding tunes. Apparently this was the place that the townspeople went after almost any celebration, and the jukebox provided them with a substitute for a band.
Oh, that sounds good.
That's wonderful. Remember that place, Michael, had the fattest waitresses that we've ever seen? I should talk. I know people on the radio can't see us, but people always look at me and say, well, she must do all the eating and he must do all the riding. I mean, after road food, I think I put on 30 pounds. But this one particular diner in Indiana, I don't think any waitress weighed under 300 pounds, and it was really a good advertisement for their food, which was delicious.
Did you ever think that in places where the waitresses are older, that it's a place that's probably been around for a long time, where people have grown with the restaurant and working
for
years? Well,
you know, old people are really, getting back to your earlier question of what a good sign of road food would be, old people are often a sign of excellent cooking because they really are interested in the old ways of cooking and they have the time and the patience. As a matter of fact, one of our favorite restaurants is in Clarendon, Texas. It's a place called Mrs. Bromley's Dining Room, and it's actually in Mrs. Bromley's house, and she's a woman who must be in her upper 70s, and you come into her house, and she has a smorgasbord set out for you, 6 kinds of homemade biscuits, 7 pies, big ham, big turkey, and at the end of the meal, she came up to us, and she said, "You know, I see you've been sitting here eating for 2 hours. You look very tired. Why don't you go up, take a nap in my bedroom, and then when you're refreshed, come down and eat some more." So it's kind of a really nice way to go.
So how many times did your car break down when you were riding road food?
Only one. It really broke down in that
It broke down in Washington, that? Pennsylvania,
That's
home of the Cozy Cottage. We actually, because our car broke down, we found a very good meal. I can't even remember what the meal was. It was a kind.
I remember it ended with peanut butter pie.
Peanut butter pie.
Terrific.
That's right. And we probably would never have stopped there had our engine just
yeah. The car knew more
out.
Than we did.
What kind of car do you have, or did you have?
Well, we had a Volkswagen Rabbit, and it was absolutely horrible. And we swore we'd never get another one. And we just went out 2 weeks ago and bought a Volkswagen Rabbit, which says something about our.
But we've been through a lot of cars in between that. We've put several hundred thousand miles on our cars doing road food.
Do you worry? Well, I guess Volkswagens are easy to find parts for, but when you know you're going to be on the road a lot, you always try to find a car where if you break down any place, you can find a car.
Yeah, we were thinking of that, but I have a bad back, and since I can't afford, I had to get a German car, and I can't afford a Mercedes, so the Volkswagen was the only one I could sit in comfortably.
You know, actually, when we started out to do road food, this is typical Stern methodology.
Oh, yes.
We got our advance from the publisher, and we bought, I think it was, God, like a $13,000 GMC motorhome thing to drive around, and thinking, well, this is a great way to save money. We will never have to stay in a motel. So instead, we spend thousands of dollars on this dumb thing. We camped out one night in it and hated it so much. We were so uncomfortable that we swore we would never do it again. That afternoon, we were in North Carolina, and we were back-ended by a fully loaded cement truck, which just accordion the car, also spilling Michael's collection of barbecue sauces that he had been collecting through the whole route.
It was really a gory-looking accident.
And we were fine. We weren't hurt in the slightest, but ambulances came from every little burg around because they saw just, you know, a mile of barbecue sauce.
And they couldn't understand why I was why I was more unhappy about the barbecue sauce than the car.
Right,
you know, because,
we hated the car.
You were able to get insurance on that and buy what you really wanted.
It was just totaled, which was
Did you get sick and tired of staying in motels?
That was the worst thing about doing road food. You know, we would almost never get sick of finding really good food. I mean, occasionally we wouldn't find any, and that was sort of depressing when we couldn't get a good meal. But it was the staying in motels night after night that made us come back after, say, 2 or 3 months, because that is what is really grueling.
What do you hate about that?
The sameness. The anonymity.
Yeah, there's something very depressing about the ritual of pulling into the motel, opening the door, there's the shag rug. Okay, now what? Well, let's go to the motel dining room and we'll get our bottle of club soda. Where's the ice machine? You know, we sort of park ourselves for the night. Where's the TV listings? What's this weird channel? Trying to figure out what channels correspond to Connecticut channels and where our favorite shows are. And
after a couple of trips, we actually took some pictures, you know, like framed pictures of our dog and our friends, and would just, like, the minute we walked into the motel room, just take down their ugly art and just tape up pictures of our friends and our dog just so it had some semblance of our real life, you know.
Would you ever pick up hitchhikers?
We used to, but I think we heard too many scare stories about it, so we stopped. I always wondered what if I had to hitchhike someplace, what I would do to try and make myself look non-psychotic or crazed or something.
I decided that might be impossible because, you know, if you've seen enough, like, O'Hara films, for instance, or even Hitchcock movies, where everybody has a double-edged side about
mm-hmm.
them, and they initially look like just an ordinary person, but if you look hard enough, you can always find something suspicious in someone
exactly.
you don't know.
Especially after that horrible guy on the West Coast who killed all those women.
Oh, the highway murder.
That looked so straight. I mean, actually, I think if I had a choice, I'd rather pick up somebody who had shackles on or a striped
a shaved
suit
head.
Rather than a guy with a crew cut in a suit, because you figure there's got to be something really wrong with that guy with a suit on.
Did you used to hitchhike?
No, not really. Well, Jane did some hitchhiking of sorts when she did the Trucker book, but that was somewhat more formalized than just standing on the road with a thumb out. But
yeah, the last time I hitchhiked with a trucker, and I think actually if you had to choose between hitchhiking with a trucker and just any old car on the highway, I'd choose a trucker because, you know, he's not in his truck to rob banks usually. I mean, he's sort of a professional driver, and I'm sure he knows how to drive. But the last time I hitchhiked with a trucker, the guy was driving along, and it was really late at night, and we were having a very nice conversation, and he pointed to the road, and he said, look at that couch. And I said, what couch? And he said, that couch.